Have you ever wondered what the stars have to say about your favorite artists and writers? Listen to Stars and Stars with Issa, where I, your host and astrologer, Issa Nakazawa, read and interpret astrological birth charts of luminaries like W. Kamau Bell, Gia Tolentino, and so many more. You'll discover how astrology can unlock fascinating insights about these stars, and who knows, maybe you'll learn a little bit more about yourself. Listen to Stars and Stars with Issa wherever you get your podcasts.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Hello, this is Virginia Heffernan, and welcome to This is Critical, where we examine all of our cultural assumptions, like that QR codes are simply functional when they're clearly beautiful. It's a big story today, so I want to start out with the occasion for this episode and the backstory. Basically, on April 6th, last week, Larry Ray, a strange New York cult leader, was convicted in federal court for sex trafficking, extortion, conspiracy, and a bunch of other crimes. The investigation into Ray, who started his cult in September 2010, was kicked off by my guests today, James Walsh and Ezra Marcus. They published a story about him in New York Magazine in 2019, when he was still a free man, unconvicted, and still up to his culty ways. So that's the peg. Now the backstory. Larry Ray, whose biography you'll hear so much more about, was in prison even before he started his cultic rampage in 2010. He was there for a slightly more pedestrian reason, contempt of court. What had happened was that he was in the midst of a complicated custody battle with his ex-wife, and he'd refused to hand over custody of his two children. One of those kids, Talia, was a student at Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York, very close to Manhattan, by the time her father got out of prison. Now, Talia idolized her dad, and she parroted his kind of ex-con baffle gab about how he was innocent and an action hero, and he'd only been sent to prison because he was targeted by a vast conspiracy. Larry Ray was excellent at this kind of snow job storytelling, and Talia, like so many of us, grew up enthralled by her dad. Even as a college student, she could be counted on to do whatever he asked, and she ended up bringing in a group of young adults whom he trafficked, abused, and defrauded. There are a lot of people involved in this story, all of whom were under Larry Ray's spell, and one of them still is. You're going to hear these people referenced by name throughout the episode, and the names are in the public record. So I'm going to introduce you to the cast. First off, as I said, is Talia Ray, daughter of the cult boss Larry Ray. She is an unindicted co-conspirator in the case, perhaps because she brought other people to her father, who then abused them. Isabella is next. She was Talia's best friend, and she's now Larry's indicted co-conspirator. Isabella is still very much under Larry's thumb and in his thrall. You're going to hear more about that. And then there's Daniel, another roommate who is in psychological turmoil at the time Larry came into his life. There's Santos, another student at Sarah Lawrence and a former boyfriend of Talia's. He joined Larry Ray's group, and so did two of his sisters who were not Sarah Lawrence students. Finally, there's Claudia, a student who turned to sex work for years at Larry's behest to make money for him. It's a grim story. James Walsh and Ezra Marcus broke this story back in 2019. James is a staff writer at New York and the author of the book Playing Against the House. In his reporting, he spent some time with Larry and experienced Ray's extraordinary manipulation skills up close. Ezra is a freelance journalist, and he graduated from Sarah Lawrence College right around the same time as Larry Ray's victims. For both of these guys, for Ezra and James, it seems like last week's conviction was the end to a really heavy chapter, and I'm glad they were able to make some time to share this story with This Is Critical. James and Ezra, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Well, this is a big week for you guys because Larry Ray, the guy you wrote about 3 years ago, has at last been convicted. So tell me about Larry Ray.
Where to begin? He's definitely one of a kind.
Yeah, in my mind, there's two Larry Rays. Well, maybe three. I think there's the Larry Ray that his victims knew, which was this guy who started off as being very charming and fascinating and magnetic, and then quickly changes to become an abusive, extremely vindictive control freak. There's the sort of Larry Ray in the media, which I think people say he's, you know, the most evil person that they could think of. And even the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District called him an evil man. And then there's kind of the Larry Ray that I got to know personally and that Ezra certainly knows about, which is somebody who's just exhausting. And he's just somebody who's out for himself and maybe even a case study in kind of psychoanalytics that's beyond my comprehension.
It's also, he's a very New York character. I mean, he's from Brooklyn, he's from Bay Ridge, and he's crossed all these lines in as far as like parts of New York civil society that he's participated in. I mean, he's been a Wall Street guy, kind of on like the seamy side of Wall Street. He's been a political kind of fixer.
Yeah, so you write about how he was kind of palling around with this sort of interesting group of New Yorkers, like Bernie Kerik, who was commissioner of the NYPD in the 90s and later convicted of tax fraud, partly because Larry informed on him, right? And then there's Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York City, later Trump's fixer. But then there's also a non-New Yorker, Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union. So Larry would sort of escort Gorbachev around New York. Is that right?
There is a Forrest Gumpian quality there.
Yes, Forrest Gump of New York City. But I was going to say back up, but actually fast forward to why we're even talking about him. Like, tell us in a nutshell about Sarah Lawrence.
Yeah, okay. So in 2010, Larry gets out of prison. He's been there for 3 years, and he goes to visit his daughter, Talia Ray, who is a Sarah Lawrence student. And he spends a lot of time visiting her in her dorm, which is like a kind of on campus but freestanding house with 8 bedrooms where she's living with, you know, some of the friends she met her freshman year. This is sophomore year. Talia had spent the prior year basically telling them about how her dad is this heroic character. I mean, she would describe him as like a political prisoner who went to prison because of a conspiracy. Basically, she was like, my dad's in prison because he exposed Kerik's corruption. So, you know, her friends would hear these stories and basically thought that her dad was a good guy.
All right. So they've heard all these stories from Talia, and then Larry just shows up. So what happens next?
Basically, Larry moved in.
Okay.
And he ended up spending, you know, the better part of a few months there. And he sort of set up shop. He became a fixture in the living room. He would, you know, make dinner for the kids who live there, tell them about his life, talk about, you know, philosophy, what have you. And I think, you know, for some of these kids, some of Talia's friends, some of them immediately took to him and they're like, oh, this is sort of like a cool dad character.
And so the ones who initially bought into this idea of Larry as a political prisoner, or as you say, like a kind of cool dad, they're sort of primed to believe the stories he tells them, right? Stories like he was a secret agent who'd recovered Stinger missiles from the black market, or engineered a ceasefire in Kosovo. And basically, he was telling them he was a very important geopolitical figure, right?
You know, he didn't just come with these stories. He also came armed with, you know, literally a letter thanking him for his role in engineering the ceasefire in Kosovo, written on NATO letterhead. You know, he came, you know, if you Google imaged him, back then, the first picture that would have came up was him sitting next to Mikhail Gorbachev. The central narrative here is that he took down Bernie Kerik, you know, right. When Bernie Kerik was going to, you know, become the first, you know, Homeland Security Secretary, it was Larry who let the world know that he was corrupt. And that was the whole reason, you know, these kids were told why he had gone to prison. And so it's not only is he like this cool international man of mystery, he's also somebody who's been deeply wronged by the system. Like, he's this action figure, this action character who's on the run from this cabal of Bernie, Kerik, Giuliani associates. And so that is one element, and that is definitely central to like his mythology. But also, you know, he is the cool dad. I don't think you can underestimate that element too. And in a way, he's like counterculture at Sarah Lawrence because he's this tri-state area macho guy that I think has probably stood out on Sarah Lawrence's campus. And he like knew about reality and life outside of this liberal arts campus in a way that maybe was appealing.
Tell us about the Sarah Lawrence campus, because it's surprising to me. I can see him as a novelty to some students, but why didn't he just stick out like a sore thumb to other students and especially the administration?
I think a lot of people just didn't know he was there. He was someone's dad, so that kind of made sense to people. You hear in passing, someone's dad is here. You wouldn't think that that's that weird. People's parents visit college campuses. And then I think the fact that he was actually living there isn't really information that was like widely known outside of this like small group of people. Most of them were just sort of so busy and stressed out by being a sophomore in college. They were just kind of like, oh, whatever, this guy's here. And he began kind of meeting with them one-on-one, talk about their mental health. He kind of became sort of like a counselor for some of them. He got involved in some of their interactions with their professors, with various struggles they were having at school and in their personal lives. And eventually, that summer, they moved in with him into an apartment. He was basically a friend's apartment where he was living on the Upper East Side. You know, some of them had summer jobs. They just needed somewhere to crash for the summer. Obviously, New York's expensive place to find temporary housing. And they ended up staying, you know, in the one bedroom apartment. Some of them would ended up spending the next, you know, 8-9 years of their lives under Larry's influence in one way or another.
All right. So he's living in this on-campus house, doing these kind of one-on-one amateur therapy sessions with his daughter and her friends. And then they all move from just north of Manhattan to the Upper East Side in Manhattan itself. So who were the kids involved? And why do you think they became so enchanted with this unlikely Pied Piper?
One of the first people he really became fixated on, or whatever you want to call it, was Talia's best friend, Isabella. He would actually sleep in her dorm room. And she was sort of the first to really become this part of like the inner circle. And she's also the one who's been indicted alongside him. Then there was Santos and Claudia and then Dan, I believe in that order, over a few months. Part of the appeal for them at that time was like, you know how you go to a therapist and you're like, I wish this person would just tell me what's wrong with me. I wish they were just like, you know, he did that. He would have like a meeting with them where they get coffee and he'd listen to them talk about their problems, which were totally mundane, but it felt powerful for them at the time. You know, you're homesick. You have problems with your parents. The same thing anyone feels at 19, 20. And instead of a therapist being like, that's interesting. You know, you should like, whatever, give you some vague advice. He'd be like, well, that's because you have schizophrenia and because you were molested and abused. And he would just tell them these really, and that's powerful. I mean, he sort of spun up this grand narrative where they had like really severe problems and he could help them. So I think that was really the hook, was like, you need to stay with me and I will help you. He's not a doctor. He's not a psychiatrist, but he spoke with this authority about mental health in a way that these kids, they believed him. And that gave him a real power over them.
I think about Dan's story, how, you know, Dan was one of the last ones to kind of come into the fold. And it was a meeting. Dan was anxious about two things going into the summer after his sophomore year. He was worried because he was questioning his sexuality, which was, you know, very new to him. And he was looking for summer housing. And he met Larry, you know, for coffee on the Upper East Side. Larry talked to him, listened to him, you know, talk for a few hours, told him definitively that he was not gay, said, okay, now come with me. There was a limo outside with a, you know, a bunch of Dan's friends. Get in the limo and said, hey, I've got housing figured out. You can live with us. So it was just like this, you know, 1, 2, 3 pitch. And Dan, you know, was hooked after that.
I got to say, when I was seeing a therapist at 19, I not only wanted the quick diagnosis, you know, just someone to be like, Virginia, you've got, you know, this particular syndrome, but I definitely wanted them to be like, and here's $500. And so a limo would definitely have done it for me. So one thing we talk about often on this show is just the fraud that seems to come up over and over again in our culture, whether it's companies selling things like untested wellness products or actual malefactors like Larry Ray or Keith Raniere at Nexium. I mean, it all seems to capitalize on this idea of your life is terrible, but I alone can fix it. So where did Larry learn to do this kind of coercion so convincingly?
We can't say that he actually, there was a method to his madness. Even his defense attorney said there's no method to Larry's madness. He did certainly promote himself as having, and so did his daughter, as having these government-tested and funded skills that he had learned through the intelligence community. This, you know, I think there was one email from Talia, his daughter, saying, you know, like the best possible skills from the top government specialists. At the same time, the government, when they raided his home, did recover hard drives with all these sorts of papers on psychological manipulation, kind of the psychology behind cults, just all of this really intense stuff. Whether or not Larry really studied up on that and deployed those methods, who knows? But he certainly did, let's say, control people's eating habits, control how, you know, keep them up through the wee hours of the night, you know, questioning them in these sort of really intense ways to really grind them down and get them to make these false statements and false confessions.
Yeah, that's right. False confessions. If you can believe it, this story gets even more convoluted. After the break, Ezra and James take us through what happened when Larry led the students off Sarah Lawrence's campus.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams. Now celebrating 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams is the originator of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as its ultra-soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are each made with premium materials. Get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code PODCAST15.
We're back with my guests, James Walsh and Ezra Marcus, the journalists who broke the story about Larry Ray's, do we call it a cult? All right. So all 5 of the Sarah Lawrence students, Larry Ray's daughter, Talia, her friend, Isabella, that's the one whose dorm room Larry slept in, Claudia, Dan, and Santos, all of them are now living, or at least in and out, living in Larry's one-bedroom apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And then Santos's sisters, Felicia and Yalitza, end up joining them. So was anyone skeptical of Larry in those early days?
Yeah, I think Dan is he's the first one to exercise some skepticism and eventually get out. but otherwise, it takes, what, 6 or 7 years before any of them really, because even there are periods in which they live away from, you know, the Upper East Side apartment, but still are pulled in by, you know, Larry's gravitational pull and kind of go in and out under his control.
So how did things start to get, if listeners can believe it, even worse? Not only is he getting under their skin about their psychological non-problems or the problems that he invents or incepts in them and getting physically close to Isabella, what does this look like the next few years?
Well, it becomes very much about money for some of them. He concocts this narrative in which he starts blaming them for damaging his apartment, his property, or him personally by poisoning him. And he convinces them, you know, you scratched my expensive pan. You broke the expensive piece of carpentry equipment that I have in my apartment for some reason. He brings them down to his stepfather's property in North Carolina, has them doing yard work, which they have no idea how to do, rents all this expensive equipment, and then accuses them of damaging the equipment. And so he basically starts telling them that they owe him tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then he tells them that not only that, but, you know, he's been sick and his daughter's been sick and Isabella got sick. And that's because somebody must have been poisoning them. And under extreme pressure, you know, he'll sort of badger them all night, like, admit what you did. And eventually he wears them down until they admit to it. And then he starts getting them to document these things, to give them written and taped confessions where he says, like, if you don't start paying me back for all this damage you've done to me, I'm going to send you to prison because you wrote this confession. And these kids are freaking out. He would tell them they would have a blackened soul, if I think that was the phrase, if they didn't pay him, and that they would go to prison.
Were there any demonstrable scratches on things or damage to carpentry equipment? Ezra's just shrugging his shoulders.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. I don't want to definitively say there was never a scratch made on any of the... I mean, first of all, one thing to know about Larry is he has a almost pathological kind of accumulative tendency towards heavy machinery that he doesn't really seem to know how to use. And he would fill everywhere he lived with, like, just absurd mechanisms, like carpentry angle grinders and digging, like, backhoes and all this stuff. And so, yeah, of course this stuff may have gotten damaged, but it's like when you fill a one bedroom apartment with, like, $50,000 of, yeah, like, you know, circle saws and lathes. Yeah, it's like no one there seems to really know how to operate it. It's like, it seems to me like it's almost like a setup where you put something expensive, tell people who don't know how to use it to spend, you know, long days in the sun using it to dig holes, and then be like, wow, look at this damage you've incurred.
Ooh, oh, so how did those kids get that kind of money?
So with Santos, that means... borrowing money from his parents, asking his parents multiple times a week. They would, you know, his parents couldn't really afford this, but they would borrow money from friends and give him thousands and thousands of dollars. In one case, he stole $12,000 from his parents' small business. Claudia eventually became an escort and spent for some years exclusively giving all the money she made to Larry, and which ended up totaling an astonishing $2.5 million. Based on seeing multiple clients a day, 7 days a week, living only in hotels and devoting her life to trying to pay back the money that she was worried if she didn't pay it to Larry, he'd send her to jail for. And yet the amount that he said they owed him never seemed to go down. It was just this, like, endless sort of, I mean, con, really, is one way to look at it. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure I'm not the first person to notice that there's so many uncanny rhymes in the Larry Ray story with some more recent stories of scammers. There's the so-called bad vegan who gave all her money to someone who had crazy stories about his CIA connections. And then there's the Tinder swindler who was able to get all kinds of money. Both of those scams were turned into docs on Netflix. Now, in those cases, the one guy was using the money for gambling. And the other one seemed to just be using the money for the high life, like private planes or Breitling watches or whatever. But what did Larry want with millions of dollars?
You know, this part's kind of maddening because there's no real good answer to that. He spent about $1 million on domain names, which a lot of, makes
so just
sense.
Just a blue chip investment you're talking about. Exactly. Like something you can really retire on.
Exactly. I mean, on the surface, that looks like a money laundering effort. a kind of strange way to launder your money. But he, you know, in years of holding 8,000 domain names, I think he's sold only a handful of them for about $50,000. It is almost like his virtual hoarding, you know, the way he collected all this stuff. He also collected domain names. He loved to collect domain names that directly, you know, were like part of his life, like, you know, MikhailGorbachev.com. And he, you know, had a whole suite of domain names related to Bernie Kerik and his family, and, you know, owned the domain names for all the names of all the people around him, the kids from Sarah Lawrence and all that. It was, that was a way he also exercised his control over them. One of the kind of, if you could call it a fun revelation from the trial, was how much money he was spending on his own clothing, which was pretty amazing.
So there is a Tinder swindler element to it.
I mean, maybe, okay. Yeah, I mean, he spent, like, there was one Loro Piani shirt he bought for $2,500. But he was also living in, you know, suburban New Jersey at the house of some guy he met while he was, you know, in prison. So it's not exactly what I would spend $2.5 million on, but he was spending it to a certain extent.
He definitely did take people out to steak dinners a lot. Big fan of steakhouses.
And right, I mean, that part of the seductions in the beginning where the limos and the steaks came from him, then the, like, faucet goes the other way when he starts getting money from Claudia for all the sex work. That's astonishing that it was that much money. Somehow I had this experience with Bad Vegan too. I was like, all right, she gave him $10,000. That is a huge bummer. That's a huge bummer. That's terrible. And then it just starts ticking up in the, you know, how much until it turns into the millions. And you just can't believe, I mean, this is kind of a sidebar, but I just can't believe that that much money exists in the world, just washing around through people into Loro Piana shirts. All right. Is there anything else I'm missing about the money from Larry?
I think for him, money is just another element of control. I mean, what this guy gets off on is control. And so it's one, being able to provide for Isabella and his daughter and his father. He loved to give them money, but also just like having money coming in from Claudia and Santos and Yalitza. I mean, that was just a way of feeling like he had control over them.
So Yalitza, she's one of Santos's sisters, right? And there was another way that Larry showed he had control, and that was sexual control, physical control. This part gets very dark, but would you tell us a little bit about it?
A big thing that came up in the trial was, you know, this notion of grooming and how he kind of pushed these people ever further towards sexual behaviors that they wouldn't have been comfortable with. You know, he encouraged Claudia to work at a BDSM club and then become a sex worker, and he would sort of instruct the people he was living with to have sex with each other and do it sort of publicly. And he would sort of humiliate them sexually. You know, he would make them put a dildo in their mouth in front of the group. And it was all sort of about breaking down their boundaries, embarrassing them, humiliation, but also making them willing to sort of do whatever sexual thing he asked. And he would tell them, if you don't do this, like, you're not liberated. Like, it's good to be liberated. I mean, with Felicia, one of the victims who testified at the trial, he just would tell her to go and have sex with strangers and videotape it. And it was about control.
Right. Felicia, she's the other of Santos's sisters. All right. So did Larry use that as some kind of blackmail, or what was he trying to get out of that? Just more control?
Exactly. There's also different reasons why he exercises control over certain people. It's not just money. I mean, I think a big part of Felicia's story is that, you know, she went to Harvard and then Columbia Medical School. And I think Larry really liked having somebody with those sort of credentials under his control, under his power. And he would humiliate her by having her walk around in her graduation cap. You know, I think one picture showed her Harvard diploma hung up on the wall in his apartment. And he would constantly, you know, tell her, oh, you have to go by Dr. Rosario. And then her audio recordings of him just really degrading her and in truly awful ways. And I think he really liked that element of lording over somebody with these Ivy League degrees.
So, right. You have to use this name, and then he would humiliate her. Wow. Yuck.
Anything that they sort of loved or treasured outside of his sphere, he would use that as a weapon against them.
It's sort of impossible to name which one of these stories is the most heartbreaking because they're all heartbreaking in their own ways. But James, can you tell us about Isabella? She's still wrapped up in this, right?
Sure. Isabella is Larry's indicted co-conspirator. She'll go on trial this summer. But she went to an all-girls school in Texas and was very quiet and shy, got a full ride to Sarah Lawrence and became friends with Talia. And Larry kind of swooped into her life sophomore year when she was looking for somebody to talk to and this kind of authority figure. And there's a real kind of breaking point. I mean, it's Larry had been living in the dorm for about a month before winter break, and Larry calls her family at the beginning of winter break and says, you know, Isabella's not coming home because it's abusive there and she's going to stay with me in my apartment over winter break. And so she, the government has called her Larry's lieutenant because she kept all of his books. Most of the bank accounts Larry used over the past few years have been in her name. She is sort of his ride or die. And a year after his arrest in March 2021, she was indicted and is facing some serious charges.
Yeah. And on top of all this, so she's been charged with racketeering, extortion, sex trafficking, just like Larry. And also like Larry, she's pled not guilty. You spent time with both of them, right, James? What was that like?
When I spent time with Larry and I spent time with Isabella, it was a bizarre situation because on the one hand, Larry was describing Felicia, whom I also met as his wife. And then on the other hand, he was treating Isabella there in front of me like his girlfriend. They really kind of behaved in this obsequious sort of like, you know, he only speak unless if prompted by Larry to do so, you know, and only really talk to like affirm his talking points. It was a very bizarre couple of conversations I had with them.
So what every parent seems to ask is, what about the parents of these kids, of Santos, of Isabella and Talia's mother? So Larry Ray's ex-wife, what were they doing and thinking? There must have been someone who made this their crusade to get these kids out.
They all tried in various ways. The Santos's parents, the Rosarios, you know, went to the police multiple times, different precincts, and they just couldn't really get anybody to take this on. They were basically told like, well, they're adults, you know, they're making a choice.
There were various, kind of rescue attempts throughout the years too. And even after our story came out, you know, Santos's mother, Isabella's aunt went to Larry's house and tried to get the kids to come outside. There were police there. It is a nightmare for parents to see this happening and realize that they're acting too late, you know, and of no fault of their own. It's just that I think these people get their hooks in early and it can happen really fast.
Even the ones that got called about money, their children tell them Larry would hurt them if they didn't wire more money.
Well, they said they would hurt themselves. Yeah. So, you know, Santos in particular would say, hey, I'm feeling suicidal. I've broken all of Larry's stuff. If I don't pay him back, I hate myself. And so I'm going to hurt myself. And so, you know, suicide was sort of a big topic of conversation, a kind of a fascination for Larry. And Larry would talk about all of the suicide attempts that his kind of followers collectively have made. And he would talk about it as almost a point of pride that, hey, look at all these people who are attempting suicide and they've all come to ask for help from me. And so that was a really big thing.
And remember, Santos wasn't the only member of his family in Larry's circle. His two sisters, Felicia and Yalitza, were also tangled up in this. Their parents ran a small travel agency, and they took out loans and even sold their house in an attempt to get their kids back, or at least get them out of Larry's debt. After the break, the trial, and what this case tells us about how institutions and figureheads can betray us.
Have Have you ever wondered what the stars have to say about your favorite artists and writers? Listen to Stars and Stars with Issa, where I, your host and astrologer, Issa Nakazawa, read and interpret astrological birth charts of luminaries like W. Kamau Bell, Gia Tolentino, and so many more. You'll discover how astrology can unlock fascinating insights about these stars, and who knows, maybe you'll learn a little bit more about yourself. Listen to Stars and Stars with Issa wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams. Now celebrating 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams is the originator of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as its ultra-soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are each made with premium materials. Get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code PODCAST15.
Welcome back to This is Critical. Today, my guests are James Walsh and Ezra Marcus, two journalists who are walking us through the case of Larry Ray, the so-called Sarah Lawrence sex cult dad. Okay, so tell me about the trial.
I mean, I thought the prosecution did a really good job, but also they had a mountain of evidence. Like, they had so much documentation of criminal behavior that Larry had made himself and just kept on his computer. And it's these videos that he's recording of him verbally and physically abusing people. So on the one hand, it's kind of like served up to the prosecution on a silver platter, right? Mm-hmm. He had something like 50 devices and just endless gigabytes of stuff they had to sort of sift through to find the most kind of damning material. The defense would always say that these kids were storytellers. It was a group of storytellers. And it's like, okay, so, like, yeah, Larry, maybe he, whether or not he believed it, we are seeing him commit crimes on tape. A big part of the trial was about whether or not he truly believed that these things had happened to him, or whether he was pretending that he believed in order to be more convincing, where the defense was saying, no, he was convinced by these stories the kids would make up about poisoning him at the behest of this conspiracy. He would basically make them admit that Bernie Kerik had somehow induced them to poison him. And the defense was trying to say essentially that was exculpatory, and that because he believed he'd been poisoned, it was all right to take this money.
Wait, so there was also another kid, right, who wasn't included in the initial story or the trial. Is that right? Can you tell us about Iban?
We wrote about this, but there's a story that the jury never even heard about, which was this guy, Iban, who was Talia's ex-boyfriend in high school, and he was very much under Larry's influence, and Larry encouraged him to join the Marines, likely not knowing at the time that Larry himself had never been in the Marines. Mm-hmm. And Iban came back from doing 2 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and immediately started living with Larry. And he was suffering from PTSD. And talk about, like, the last person, again, in the world you want to have coaching somebody through PTSD. And Larry really took advantage of that. You know, Iban was his personal driver. Iban was going to him, asking him for help as a kind of a therapy, and talked about how Larry was his mentor. Iban was living in and out of shelters. And Iban eventually killed himself a few months after Larry was indicted.
So, James and Ezra, you saw many of the victims at Larry Ray's recent trial. Did any of them seem like they'd finally broken free of his influence?
They all did.
Yeah. Really?
They all expressed on the stand some indications of the trauma they had gone through, often just in the lengthy pauses between questions and answers, where they wanted to gather themselves and explain as thoroughly as they could how somebody could be so entranced and so hypnotized. All of them at the end of their testimony said that this man totally messed up their lives, completely screwed up their lives. And that was powerful. And the Rosario siblings, all 3 of them, were there for the verdict, holding hands in the back row, which was, I think, really, really powerful.
What was the jury's response
I mean, this seems like it was pretty grueling.
Yeah, it was kind of fascinating. I don't know if it's because of masks or what, but they were a pretty stoic jury. It was hard for us to have any sense of what they were thinking. It's funny, we were talking about, you know, when they were dismissed to go deliberate by the judge, like, it was just amazing to me that they could sit through 3 weeks of that, and that was the first time they were allowed to talk to each other about this absolutely wild story.
Right.
We were like, it's going to take them an hour just to, like, vent to each other, and finally they can talk about it. They deliberated for about 4 hours, which with 15 federal counts that they were going through, that is fast.
Yeah.
You know, that is fast. And they found him guilty on all 15 charges.
So this story really brings into focus kind of the dark side of what we think of as safe roles and institutions, father figures on the one hand, and on the other, the idea that liberal arts colleges are supposed to be these kind of operate in loco parentis, serve as safe spaces where close-knit friendships can be formed. How did Ray exploit all of these ideas?
I think it speaks to the power of group dynamics, right? Like whether or not he understood this, but it was really effective, I think, for these kids to be, you know, hermetically sealed in this group where they're in an apartment with their best friends, and their friends are all saying something because they're sort of being influenced to do so, or told to do so, and yelled at to do so. And so once you get these kids in a kind of environment that Larry controlled, he set the terms for what's normal. And he was able, I think, to use these group dynamics to really shift these people into this, like, upside down, you know, like, crazy reality, just by exploiting the fact that young people especially kind of are relying on their friends to set the tone for what they should be doing and what's acceptable.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because college also opens your own idea of what's kind of acceptable behavior. But then when it combines to this and you sort of pass through that over the Rubicon until you're, like, really forfeiting yourself, that's, I think, where it gets terrifying, and also where a young person might not be able to identify that line.
Yeah, and I mean, that's also something, it's funny that you say that, because the defense really keyed in on it as part of their defense that that the environment at Sarah Lawrence is somehow responsible for Claudia's descent into sex work. And like, they kept on bringing up this sleaze week, you know, I don't know, a kind of sexual liberation week at Sarah Lawrence. Maybe there's some element to that, but only, I think, in so much as Larry exploited it. It was like Larry saw these kids. I think at one point, Claudia testified about talking about her, you know, use of ecstasy, and Larry encouraging it. And so, like, to have a father figure sort of encourage that, like, again, he just takes advantage of that, like, that cool dad figurehead. But it's truly like a wolf in sheep's clothing. I mean, kind of the worst person you would want in that role.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unsettling that he took advantage of a father figure role. But I mean, I guess no one willingly goes into a cult. I mean, that was certainly true in the Nexium case. You know, that was just another cult type group under the guise of kind of psych up, you know, rise and grind work seminars, I guess. And it was very hard for people at the time to say, this is a really bad thing that's happening in the midst of a setting where you aren't looking for this kind of power dynamic manipulation. And I know in the case of Larry Ray, the media has latched onto calling it a cult, which seems appropriate. But I wonder, for you guys, when you've both tossed and turned at night thinking about this story with all these voices in your head, how does it settle for each of you? You know what? I'm going to be like one of those jurors after hearing all the testimony, like James said, going into the room and just being like, what the actual fuck? Like, what is this? James, what is it?
As you said, there are echoes of all of these other stories out there right now. And if there's, you know, it's like, what can we learn from the common threads? And it's a story about coercive control. And if anything, I think people who have been in abusive relationships can recognize what Larry did, and just did it on an entirely, like, an entirely different scale, an entirely different level. And so, like, Larry's story is two different stories. It's about this awful, you know, coercive control kind of commune he set up on the Upper East Side, but he also had this very wild, colorful history. And I think what was unique about Larry is that we could go back through his history and kind of explain this wild conspiracy that he wielded over them because of the different, like, points in his life, because of that Forrest Gumpian past that mm-hmm. kind of then manifested itself in this conspiracy later on, which was, I think, fascinating for us as writers and journalists. That part is what made it unique. But otherwise, the tactics and abuse that these kids suffered are recognizable to anybody who's been in these sorts of relationships, just kind of on steroids.
Mm. Ezra.
One thing that I've seen a lot of is sort of just commentary out there about how this is because, like, liberal arts students are these vulnerable, you know, special snowflakes or whatever you want to call it, like, sort of trying to drag us in some kind of, like, culture war spectrum, or just say that this was because they were, like, liberal arts kids who are vulnerable and, like, you know, you see a lot of, like, well, I'd never let my kids fall for this or whatever. But it's like, what we've seen from all these cases is that this really can happen to anybody. And it just so happened that these were, you know, that these were young people at a college. But we've seen across these types of, you know, NXIVM, what have you, that people of all ages and of all backgrounds can fall for this set of tactics and strategies that people like Larry employ. And I think in terms of what this group actually was, it's not unique, and these weren't especially vulnerable people. Nobody thinks it's going to happen to them. It's just something that there's a sort of set of tools that in psychology that have been found to effectively disconnect people from reality and assert control over them.
Yeah. It's like coronavirus. We all have lungs and we all have psychologies, and they can be exploited. I think I'm the only person who worries about Mike Pence every day because Mike Pence was sycophantic to someone, yesed him for so long, and then there was violence incited against him, and there was a call for his hanging, like an actual lynching, and Pence still defends Trump. I mean, he's like Isabella, Ray's co-conspirator. I really think that there are certain personalities, and in a way, the more repellent they are to the rest of us, the more appealing they are to the people who fall for them, you know?
Yeah, I think that throughout the reporting process, we sort of would joke about, we would just be like, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it. And it'd be like, okay, it's Trumpian.
You know, like, I know. Damn it. It's like, it's our model. Right, I guess it, like, took a long time to dethrone Charlie Manson or Jim Jones. And now we finally have a touchstone, and that'll last the next 50 years. All right, well, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
That's it for this week's episode of This is Critical. Make sure you don't miss next week's episode by following us and subscribing on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Pandora, or wherever you like to listen. And if you like what you hear, please take a moment to give us a rave and rate the show in Apple Podcasts. It helps other people learn about the show. For more information and to keep tabs on us, follow me on Twitter at @Paige88 and at @ThisCriticalPod. If you've got a question or a cultural creed you think deserves another look, send us an email at thisiscriticalpod@gmail.com. This is Critical is made by me, Virginia Heffernan, and Stitcher. Corinne Wallace and Michelle O'Brien are the producers. Tracy Samuelson is our editor. Brendan Burns mixed this episode and composed our original theme. And Josephine Martirana is our executive producer. Thanks for listening, and stay critical. Stitcher.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.